The system works against someone who doesn't understand what the rules are, and who doesn't even recognize that there are resources that perhaps if they made use of them and initiated that contact on their own, they might prevent something spiraling out of control.
PodBN
Elections Edition.
Here we go from the Play Normal Esports Studio. This is PodBN Elections Edition. I am Tyson.
And I am Zach, filling in for Justin.
And today we're going to talk to Karen Smith, who's running for the Normal Town Council. Before we talk to her, just want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Little Beaver Brewery. Zach, I understand you were at Little Beaver recently.
Little Beaver, exciting week recently with the big win for the Chamber of Commerce Gala, and it's a great place. I think if you haven't tried it yet and you're in Bloomington Normal, you have got to get there now.
What did you have when you were there? Do you recall?
I tend to stick to their IPAs. They have some really good beers, though, all around that they've done some cool experiments with. I can't remember what I had most recently, but every time I go there, I find something I like.
Yeah. I appreciate the way that they just think outside the box and put stuff like coffee and vanilla and strawberries and whatever and just see what happens.
Their outdoor festivals that they've had are phenomenal too. They've put together some limited release brews that they've had, and they are just phenomenal. Whether it's a porter, whether it's an ale, it's a good place to be.
Yeah. All right. Well, Karen, thanks a lot for coming to join us today.
Thank you for having me. Right. Pleasure to be here.
So to start off, we just like people to explain a little bit about their background, how long you've been in town, what have you been involved in, things like that.
Well, my husband and I moved here in 2008. He had been working for Turner Broadcasting in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a programmer, and he was working on a project at the time that I think was ahead of its time, because its structure was to develop a system for offering college sports, non-revenue producing sports, to alumni on a subscription basis. And that really was not the market model at the time. And when Turner ran the numbers and saw that, people got their pink slips. He put his resume out, and State Farm answered the call. And so we took the position up here. The economy was just beginning to slow, and actually, in the past, when he had gone job hunting, he'd had multiple offers, but this was telling that there was such a sound of crickets when he put his resume online in the early part of 2008, and I was reluctant to move up here. I've lived in the Midwest, and I remember brutal winters, but when faced with a choice between being cold but being inside a house that we could pay the mortgage on and staying put and potentially not being able to pay the mortgage, State Farm was a godsend to us. And so we came here in that summer, and in January of 2009, I was able to get a position with Illinois State.
And you're a professor there?
I am. I teach in the College of Business. I have an MBA with a concentration in accounting from Indiana University, and have taught managerial and financial accounting for Illinois State. Prior to that, part of the reason they gave me this opportunity is I had taught for Georgia Perimeter College, which is now part of Georgia State University in Atlanta, since 2006.
Mm-hmm. So you had taught before. Had you ever done any sort of other jobs?
Well, once I had my MBA, I worked first for an insurance company in Indianapolis, and then found myself with a concentration in retirement housing. First as a business manager at a community, then doing consulting work, in fact, doing financial feasibility studies for two different firms over a number of years, and then made a career switch to actually sell insurance for Equitable for more than 10 years. But when we adopted our children, I recognized that commission sales were not compatible with trying to support two special needs kids. Mm-hmm. So the decision was made to try to focus on teaching, which has given me the flexibility to be available to them.
Yeah. So how else do those lifestyles compare, the one you have now versus the, you know, finance consulting?
Well, in Georgia, it's not a question of if there's going to be a traffic problem. It's when and where is going to be the traffic problem. And so it was a very hectic and fast-paced lifestyle with a race to get the children either to childcare or to school, and then get to childcare before the deadline was struck to have the facility closed. And I think the charge was something like $10 a minute.
Wow.
If you were late. Really motivates you to try to find those good traffic routes. And the commute time was typically an hour either direction. So it was an immense change of pace to come here. And I would tell people, I says, 10 minutes. You can get anywhere in 10 minutes. Go to the movie, 10 minutes. Go to the store, 10 minutes. And we were so used to basically packing like you were going on an expedition if you wanted to travel inside the traffic areas of Atlanta.
That's funny. My kids will complain to me about that. Like my older one's real, like, you know, he's like an 8-year-old teenager basically, and so anytime his younger brothers are like, you know, how long does it take to get there? He's like, 15 minutes. Everything takes 15 minutes. Like, hey, just be thankful it doesn't take an hour. So they don't know what's good for them.
I was in Atlanta this summer, and it took us 2 hours to get from by the airport to downtown. And it was the wrong time of day, and I think it was a half an hour around one block. So I totally get that.
Yeah. Well, I do remember one time coming back from a business trip, and the plane was delayed, and it was about 2 a.m. when I'm out of the airport and driving north on I-85, and I ran to traffic at 2 a.m., and I'm thinking to myself, are you kidding me? What is their traffic doing at this time of night? This is insane.
So how are you feeling about working at ISU?
Well, ISU has been a very good environment for me because of the flexibility it offers to teach, and I'm now at a position where I'm getting a class schedule that it accommodates my needs. Early on, I was able to ask them, can you please have me only teach some classes that will get me home by 3 o'clock so that I could meet the kids and be there for them? And I so appreciate that. There have been some instances where there have been some medical emergencies at home, and very understanding of that. So I thank them very much for that. And I've had some good experiences with some of the students I've worked with, that they reach out for help, and they appreciate the support I'm able to give them, and I've gotten some thank you emails from them, and that really touches me. That's one of the reasons I like being a teacher, that when I can make a difference in someone's life like that. I once had someone remark that if you ask somebody who won the Super Bowl last year or who won the World Series, not everybody can answer that question, but if you ask them, can you name a teacher who's made a difference in your life, almost everybody has a story to share like that, and it makes me feel proud to be part of that profession.
Yeah, and ISU is a place where teachers can have more of an impact when you compare to some other universities. At least when I was there, class sizes were always kept very small. Teachers were very accessible. And that's definitely something that is, it's good for teacher. I'd always thought it was good for students, but it sounds like it's probably good for professors as well, too, right?
Oh, I've taught a business survey class where it's capped at 40 students. In the College of Business, we have what we call the horseshoe rooms, where the seating is only two seats deep, and you can actually walk into the central part of a U to get up close and personal with students. So having to interact in that climate versus the CAT auditorium. And the CAT auditorium has its place for large core classes where you have to teach the same subject to a number of students that need it for their business majors. But when I was able to get into the classrooms on the third floor that cap at 90, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
So I know that your children are a big part of your life. In as many details as you're comfortable sharing, I know that they have some challenges. So how has that impacted you?
Oh, how much time do we have?
as much as you like. It's a podcast.
Well, our children are very special to us, and both of them do have special needs. My son being male and older, I won't go into much detail about that because it would embarrass him. But I will share that some of his issues are learning disabilities and some mental health issues because of his early childhood abandonment. And so it was a challenge to get him the services he needs, and it was a frustration of mine that mental health issues are not given the same credence as physical ailments. And my own mother suffered from depression, and I witness even some family members frustrated with thinking, oh, she's faking it. And my response to any charge that a mental illness is under somebody's control or is a personality flaw is, no one would ever think of telling a diabetic to just get your insulin under control. No one would ever think of doing that, but it's all too often that someone looks at an individual that has mental illness issues and believes that that is something that if they only tried harder, they wouldn't be dealing with it. Mm-hmm. And as for our daughter, Bella, she's a pistol. We do keep her active in a number of things, and that is one thing I'm so grateful to this community about, is that Unit 5 and the school system here is so rich in what they do for her and her classmates. She was in a specialized child care center back in Georgia, and there was a preschool program. Her teacher, speaking of memorable teachers, Ms. Kuiper, who she had such a bond with those kids, but it was Ms. Kuiper and I think one assistant for 12 preschool age kids. And I've kept in touch with the parents of some of the classmates from that time period. And when I've traveled back to Georgia and talked about the services Bella is getting up here compared to there, they were envious and in shock that she was getting so much, that Bella has been going out into the community since grade school on outings to socialize her and practice skills of dealing with everyday life circumstances. And that didn't happen till high school in Georgia, because Georgia is serious about meeting budget constraints. They have a constitutional amendment that says they cannot do deficit budgets. And by God, they mean it. The last time I was down there, I noticed it was dark on the expressway. They have turned out lights on the expressway as a budget-cutting measure. And that same attitude crosses over into education and what they do and don't do. And when I mentioned to Bella's teachers up here about how I hadn't recognized it because we came into it as a matter of course that there would be these community outings on a weekly basis, the response was, well, if this person takes a longer time to learn something, don't you think it's important that they start it earlier to give them that time? And I'm like, well, that's too much like right. That attitude and that support is just phenomenal. And I want to give a shout out to all of Bella's teachers up here, Ms. Burry, Ms. Fudge, and Ms. Fairfield. They've all been instrumental in her life.
Right. So you've mentioned her in as being one of the reasons why you wanted to run for town council to try to help make the situation better.
Yes. Believe it or not, it wasn't until last fall, because Bella's 18 now, and I had been toying with the idea of after retirement, oh, I could retire and possibly teach part-time at the university after retirement. But then the light bulb moment occurred when it's like, wait a minute, after she's 21, she'll no longer be eligible for services. She will be at home with me, and if I want to teach, I'm going to have to find somebody to stay with her to allow me to be out of the house without worrying about her. And I'm like, OMG. Mm-hmm. And, huh. So that really put a whole new perspective in my mind of what do I want to make sure Bella's life is like in this community that will be her home. And one of the things that does concern me is that the financial solvency of the community needs to be solid so that there's not the temptation to cut services to people like Bella who are vulnerable and cannot advocate for themselves.
I know McLean County has been one of those areas where, especially with mental health, they have tried to step in recent years and have more of a role there. And a big part of that is as budgets grow tighter and those financial resources are limited, what role do you see, whether it's at the community level or otherwise? Is it a public-private thing that needs to happen? What's the next step? How do we improve?
Well, I am familiar with the dearth of mental health services for children and adolescents. Our son began receiving services when the Carl Clinic had a branch here in town, and he was able to begin receiving services from Dr. Hawley at that time here in Bloomington, but Carl Clinic made the decision that this was not a viable market for them, and so they relocated back into their home grounds of Champaign, and we've been able to continue that relationship now for my daughter. But there is no child psychologist or psychiatrist, and so if you don't have a car, if you don't have good insurance, that unfortunate story that was in the news of a teenager that committed suicide, I'm very much aware that can happen as a direct result of not being able to get the services when they're needed. I know that some of it is Central Illinois is not necessarily the top of the list for residents and new physicians setting up practice. I think the potential exists for us to become that. OSF and Advocate Broman are both expanding their medical services in this area. We do have a vibrant community, so that I think it could be a naturally self-feeding if we begin to get that reputation. And ISU has a number of their grads that stay on in the community, so that if we can do something to attract residents to begin their service in this community, perhaps some of them will be enticed to stay on. But for Bella, we traveled to a specialist in Peoria. We traveled to a specialist in Champaign. She had one in Springfield, but now she's going to Chicago. I can get my card punched and get frequent medical miles anytime I need to take her to any number of specialists that she has to see.
Yeah, there was a great series on that on WGLT recently that really it focused on the case that you were referring to of that girl who took her life, but did such a great job of using that as a springboard to talk about all the problems that that has. And so I think the more people who can raise awareness about that, the better. Has there been anything else that you've been involved in the community during your time that you wanted to mention?
Well, there have been a number of campaign questionnaires that have come to me from various organizations that are offering an opportunity to speak about my background. And the question tends to be phrased, do you have any prior elected office experience? Mm-hmm. Now, I will boast about the fact that I was student president of Our Lady of Providence Academy, an all-girls academy in Newport, Kentucky, a number of years ago, so I'm not sure how relevant that is today.
How far back you go.
I did serve as treasurer when Frank McCluskey in Bloomington, Indiana, ran for the congressional seat was it 1982? Or 1984, his first run against the incumbent. And my neighbor, John Goss, happened to be his deputy mayor and then campaign manager and wanted to speak to me because he knew of my accounting background. So he called me over to ask me if I would do this. And the famous phrase every time I've been asked to be treasurer is, it's not a lot of work. It's not a lot of work for you because you aren't going to be doing it.
That's right.
And he handed me a softback copy of the Federal Election Commission regulations that were recently passed following Watergate and says, oh, you need to follow these rules. And there were sample forms in there and the various items that you had to follow. And it really wasn't that much work initially, but I did consider that besides making track of the money for the campaign reports, I probably ought to make it a point to carefully include all of the contact information for the donors just in case. And it really became much more of a job when his opponent was involved in a drunken driving accident 6 weeks before the election, and the PAC money started rolling in, so my job got a lot more complicated then. But there was the database there that Frank went on to win re-election several terms past that, and I like to think that my emphasis on giving him the data he needed helped him do that. Beyond that, I've been more involved in professional and not-for-profit volunteer work when I was in Georgia before the kids. One in particular, DeKalb Juvenile Court in Atlanta metro area, ran a program to monitor foster children placement. Prior to deciding to do that, the agencies police themselves when it came to foster placement, and in response to some serious cases where things had fallen through the cracks and children had fallen through the cracks, they developed this system of volunteers that were trained to monitor on every 6 months any cases of children that had been in placement and try to develop a plan for permanency, whether that was returning the child to their parent, their birth parent, terminating parental rights and making them eligible for adoption, or a middle ground of finding some other relative that would assume long-term guardianship to give them that sense of permanency and stability. And that I did that for 5 years, and it was such an eye-opening experience. I remember the first day I came home after 8 hours of doing this with, and I think there were four cases in the morning. We took a break for lunch and four cases in the afternoon. I took a shower and stood under the hot water for an extended period of time because I had no idea there was so much pain and suffering in my backyard. And the reality at that time was that most of those children wound up in placements because of addiction. And it was a different standard because they, instead of offering treatment to these individuals, it was prison time and punishment. And that was driven home for me when the news hit during the same period I was doing this, when Rush Limbaugh lost his job for a time and went into treatment, but there was no legal pursuit of him for his partaking of illegal substances. And yet, in these cases, time after time, I was dealing with situations where individuals had similar addictions, but the legal system came down in force against them.
I think you see a lot of engagement with nonprofit organizations lead to interest in community engagement. So how has that experience kind of brought about the interest for you to get involved at a community level?
I think for me, it drove home the point that too often the system works against someone who doesn't understand what the rules are, and who doesn't even recognize that there are resources that perhaps if they made use of them and initiated that contact on their own, they might prevent something spiraling out of control and escalating to a level where legal intervention appears to be the only outcome. And so I feel it's important to reach out to people and make them aware of services and see that they do get connected with what can be provided to them to help them out. But there's just not any information available, or there might be concerns about, I don't want to share my business with outsiders. What are they going to do with this? But it humbles you to recognize that while someone may consider that, oh, well, why can't they do it because I did it? Well, if you have no knowledge of what is out there, how can you do it?
Well, thank you very much for sharing those experiences. I can tell they're very impactful on you and that they affected you very deeply. We're going to take a little break here. Feels awkward to do this now. Lighten it up a little bit with the lightning round. So I'll say a few words and you can reply back with whatever comes to your mind on that. So ISU.
Redbirds.
Shops at College Hills.
Surprising that an outdoor shopping center does so well in this climate. I know that's more than one word, but that has continually amazed me.
We will allow it due to the negative 500 degree temperatures we've been experiencing. It's an exception to the lightning round rules. Urban sprawl.
Not a fan.
Mayor Chris Coos.
Civic servant.
TIF districts.
Tough sell.
And last one is Portillo's.
I like the one that we would stop at in Chicago, coming back from Chicago. Haven't been to this one.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back with more from Karen Smith. And now we'll take a moment for Tyson's reflections on life. There's certain things that make you feel old. Two of those things happened to me this week. The eye doctor asked me if I've prepared for the fact that I may need bifocals soon. And I went to get my hair cut. And they asked if I wanted some hair regrowth shampoo. Those things happen, I guess, when you're in your mid-30s. Seems a little sooner than I would have expected, but, you know, that's life. Another thing that made me feel old recently was when I was talking to my friend, and she mentioned that her teenage sons have no interest in having any sleepovers. I was shocked. Sleepovers were the best when I was a teenager. We would stay up all night playing video games. She said they don't want to be together to play video games anymore. In fact, it's harder because they all have to have their own separate systems at their own house, and they can play video games all the time. I think it's unfortunate. Some of my favorite memories from childhood were staying up extremely late playing video games. One time in particular, my friend's mother gave us all 2-liter bottles of soda, and we stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning playing GoldenEye on what in retrospect must have been about a 10-inch wide television set. And it was glorious. Well, if you or your children are still wanting to capture some of that great experience from the times of yore and play video games physically close to each other, a great place to do that in town is Play Normal Esports. They have monitors that are a lot bigger than 10 inches. And they have soda. You can't stay here until 4, but they do have some pretty late hours. So come check them out on PlayNormalEsports.com or visit them at 802 South El Dorado Road in Bloomington. So, Karen, the two major pillars of your platform are fiscal responsibility and serving all residents. We've been talking a lot about serving all residents and your thought on that. Let's turn a little bit more to the financial side then. When you say fiscal responsibility, what comes to your mind?
Well, I've been attending the Normal Town Council meetings since the fall when I was studying how things were done and grappling with, is this something I should get involved in? And I'm aware that currently what appears to be moving forward with its own momentum is the Trail East project. At the same time, the push is on for that. Uptown One sits completed now with vacant retail space on the street level. And what was of concern at the last meeting is that apparently the latest rendition of the Trail East project now would incorporate additional square footage that, from the presentation made, it appears that the town of Normal is absorbing that additional expansion of the project with an expansion in the TIF support for the project. What was concerning to me, and I voiced this at the meeting, was that the justification that was provided in the report was presented in terms of net present value. Well, net present value is a rather sophisticated financial concept, and within the report, there wasn't the information provided to realistically interpret how that number was calculated. And to do that, you need the time factor that was used and the discount rate. In response to my question, it was a 10 to 20 year time period that was provided, but I did not hear the interest rate that was used in the discounting calculation. I think the council would be better served if it were more transparent in the assumptions that it uses. I myself worked as a consultant doing financial feasibility studies, and I know how critical it can be to use the various assumptions to create your results. One of the jokes is when you ask an accountant, what do the numbers look like? And someone can sarcastically say, I don't know, what do you want them to look like? Mm-hmm. And realistically, instead of trying to be a creative accountant, I think it's important that the town be given the opportunity to pick apart not the end results that are the focus of these reports, but let's get into a debate over what are the occupancy projections? How long will it take to fill this building? What are the rents that will be charged? What is the rate of return that's being provided? And how, is it in fact realistic for the building to make a profit so that ultimately the tax revenues do begin to revert to the community? Or is that something that needs to be an ongoing support to make the project viable? That's my concern. And before moving forward with this project, and I think that ship has sailed, so I don't know that it can be stopped, but I think the transparency would help on that. But I would like to see an audit of the Uptown One to demonstrate and to provide some reassurance. What were the original financial feasibility assumptions used? How does it compare to what is actually occurring, to provide some assurance to residents that Trail East will not provide empty retail space?
I'm glad to hear you talking about that. In my line of work as an actuary, we also make a lot of assumptions, and we can make numbers move a great deal depending on what judgment we apply to them. That's why we have such strict professional standards to make sure that we are being ethical with this. But I do worry when I see economic development projections that there are assumptions being made that we're not transparent about, and that there's not ongoing monitoring to see how those projections are matching up with actual results. You know, we talk about something like economic impact. Economic impact isn't something that you can go look at your year-end financial statement and go, oh, look, there it was. Like, we thought it was going to be $1 million, and there it is. We got our economic impact money in, you know. Again, a little on a soapbox here, but it's something I've thought a lot about. So there's two extremes. One is just to chalk everything up to economic impact. And if you build anything, it'll be awesome because the economic impact will make up the difference, right? It'll pay for itself. The other extreme is to just act like there is no economic impact to any sort of development activity. And that's naive because, you know, if people are coming into the community, they're going to be spending money and staying in hotels and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, I think there's a delicate balance there to finding what that actual impact is. And Karen, that kind of makes me think you've also mentioned some of the historical impact to the Uptown area. How do you view that? Where do you find that balance there in your thoughts?
Well, in the interview I had on GLT earlier in this campaign, I did say that the town of Normal has done a number of things right, but one of the things that separates us from Bloomington is the finite amount of Uptown. There's basically one street that is the now business area that is pedestrian friendly, because you can't really there's not the shops and restaurants along College Avenue that exist along Beaufort, and so it really isn't the same flavor as Bloomington. So anytime any effort is made to, well, let's just knock her down and put something new up that's going to be worth more, you can't replace that. I'm a big history buff, and when I saw on one of these Tracing Your Roots episodes where they went back and found the house that was 400 years old, I'm like, somebody obviously thought that building was important enough to keep it around. So at the Zoning Commission, when they took the vote on tearing down those buildings that are now being considered as part of the project, recognizing the futility of fighting something that has so much steam behind it, I at least offered the suggestion that can we not save the facades? That and I think the developers should absorb that cost in a good faith effort to show their support of the community and the history that that represents. I heard some people speak fondly of their own experiences in some of those buildings. I think was Shorty's barbershop. Now that's before my time, but even so, that they're unique structures. They have some interesting architectural character, and I don't think it all needs to look the same.
So there's been a lot of changes that have happened in Uptown over the last 15 years or so. In your mind, what are the things that were good ideas that you would have been supportive of if you'd been on council at that time? And where do you think we made the wrong choice or went too far?
Well, I think one bad choice was when they put those bump outs in the curbs, and all it took was one winter of snow plowing for them to recognize that architecturally it might have provided some interest, but hitting one of those every few feet with your snow plow, you saw them tearing those up pretty much the next season. I think there's I love the transportation center. We travel by train almost exclusively for business and pleasure, so it's wonderful to have that space. My daughter looks forward to every time that the Santa Hut goes up, and this past season they had some indoor entertainment to amuse the children as you were waiting an interminable amount of time. So I think that's worthwhile. The Uptown East, I know that did sit vacant for a number of years, and it was probably a relief to get the structure in place. But again, I would like to see what the original projections were to understand why it still doesn't have anybody in it.
Something else that's close to Uptown is the library. What are your thoughts on that? I think for a while it was going to move, and then now it's not. And so what do you think should be done there?
With the library, I would like to see it given priority over a sports complex. The library, it provides services to all residents. I grew up in a community that wasn't large enough for its own library. You had to drive about 30 minutes to get to any services. But the bookmobile was parked at the head of our road, and we would walk up to the bookmobile and wait for that person to come to start her route, and we were her first stop. And it was such a thrill to me to carry home an armload of books from that library. And that to me is what makes a difference in my life. And I've had people say, what do you think the world's greatest invention is? And I think a library is. There's no other service that provides so much knowledge and resources and community as a public library. And in terms of funding the library, I have an idea that I would like someone, and if I'm on the council, perhaps I'll have the opportunity to bring it up, is to find some funding for it. We happen to own a lot that backs up to the Constitution Trail. And I just assumed when we bought the lot that our property line went all the way up to the trail. In the recent past, though, I discovered that normal parks and rec were cutting down some of the plantings on my property. And the first time it happened, I didn't say anything. But when they went after my hostas, that was personal. And so I contacted them, and I said, why are you doing this? You shouldn't be, first of all, they're hostas, and you should recognize them. But secondly, why are you cutting down on my property? And they responded with a map showing me that, by God, my lot doesn't go all the way up. And on the plat that they gave me with 11 lots showing, four of us did not buy the easement. Now, my neighbors happened to have lived there when the railroad track was converted to Constitution Trail. And as he tells me, at that time, an offer was made to the homeowners to ask them, are you interested in buying this easement? And it was several thousand dollars. And at the time, for him, it was like, yeah, I don't want it badly enough to pay that money. But he expressed regret that he hadn't done it. Well, I'd like to have it as well, for any number of reasons. And when I asked them how I could do that, it's apparently a rabbit hole that I would have to start making phone calls. But as I looked at that, I saw an opportunity that, wait a minute, if 4 out of 11 lots just in my neighbors, roughly 40%, if 40% of us don't own that property, and if we were all given a chance to purchase it at a reasonable rate, then if you were to develop a program to look at all of Constitutional Trail in both Normal and Bloomington, find out who doesn't own it, offer them this opportunity, provide installment funding from the township or the city of Bloomington, you can develop an income stream for an asset that the towns own that isn't being used right now. It's not impacting anybody else, but it could provide a source of income that possibly could be the seed for the library.
That's really interesting. I think it's going to take some creative funding options out there to get those projects done, but it seems like you see multiple ones out there somewhere.
Well, I think it's also an idea that instead of just focusing on the income statement operating budget that the town of Normal has, why not look at the balance sheet? What other properties does the town hold title to that aren't adequately being used right now? One of the rationales for including the one building in the Trail East project is we own it and it's vacant now. Well, why is it sitting vacant? Could they not have rented it at some rate to someone on a short-term lease in anticipation of it ultimately becoming part of it? But it doesn't make any sense for an asset to not be utilized in that way.
That's an example of kind of where I was going with this. We talked a lot about Uptown Normal, but are there any other either economic development or the like of some of these financial opportunities outside Uptown that you're focused on?
But the other idea that I would like to consider, and granted, I am not in any position to initiate this conversation, but the State Farm has a wonderful recreational facility south of town. Right now, it is restricted to State Farm employees and retirees. I have heard that it's becoming a bit of a bugaboo for State Farm because their hubs in Atlanta and Dallas and Phoenix have nothing comparable, and so they find themselves asked the question about why do you have that service for your headquarters offices, but we have nothing comparable. When we first moved here, State Farm had more activities that they provided to their residents. They're not doing that anymore. It could be that it's a budget consideration. Why, instead of a soccer complex for traveling teams that are a small percentage of the sports population in town, why not look at whether or not State Farm would be interested in either opening up that park for all residents to use, or potentially a transaction where the community takes it over, and the softball fields are being underutilized. I know I, in my dotage, was compelled to keep playing on a team well past my prime because softball just isn't the sport that it used to be. Some of those could be converted to cricket, but it's a wonderful space that I think makes more sense to serve our year-round residents than to worry about attracting visiting teams to the community.
I will just mention, barring going that direction, a lot of State Farm employees don't know that we can invite large numbers of people once a year to come and visit there. You just have to fill out a form, and you can list, I think, like 40-some people. And my son has a birthday in August, and most years that's what he wants to do for his birthday. So it is a nice way to invite your friends who may not have gone there before to come and visit the facility, and something that they seem to enjoy. I think also probably helps a little bit with community outreach, too, that it's not just this gated community that only the exclusive State Farm people can go to.
I would say that if that idea were to take root, I would make sure that if there is a need or a perceived need to expand beyond State Farm, that there should be provisions made to protect the residents of the trailer park that's immediately adjacent to the State Farm water park. It realistically, if the desire is there for expansion of the space for other sports and other services, by no means would I feel that it would be justified to uproot those individuals without adequate compensation to provide them the ability to have the affordable housing that they're enjoying in their current space. So I think that does need to be part and parcel of any discussion.
I think it sounds like you can see it going a few different directions there speculatively, but do you see that as more of a State Farm solely on a private side of things opening that up, or is there an opportunity there to maybe partner with Bloomington or even Normal or the county in some way?
I think if State Farm wants to test the waters, so to speak, mm-hmm. of the interest in whether or not there is enough of a population at large that wants to make use of the facilities, then to start an experiment where it's opened up on a fee basis to guests to come in more than once a year at the invitation of an existing State Farm affiliate, and proceed from that to see, well, I do see where this has some merit. More than anything, what complicates it is physically it's probably in the Bloomington geographic area, so it doesn't really add anything to the town of Normal, and I think some consideration needs to be made to the existing patrons with the State Farm affiliations. But I ride my bike past the GE Park on Vernon and see that what probably once was a thriving recreational area is underutilized now by a dwindling pool of people eligible for that space.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting a little close to the end of our time here. Are there any topics that you still would like to talk about that we haven't covered so far?
Well, for those of you not familiar with it, ADA is the American Disabilities Act that was passed in the 1990s. And my daughters recently started attending some programs with Central Illinois. And I'm having a senior moment here because I can't think of the real name for it. But they provided a movie about the passage of that. And there was a moving image of a young girl in a wheelchair that crawled up the steps of the Capitol to drive home the point that as a citizen, the home of the legislative body of her country could not accommodate her. And so the documentary was making the point that the passage of the ADA meant a lot to people who formerly had been in the shadows. I have a cousin who has Down syndrome, and after we had Bella, I wrote to my Aunt Ronnie and I said, I have an immeasurable amount of respect for you of what you did with Billy when legally there wasn't anything he was entitled to. On a local level, there's not so much that I think is under the purview of ADA that isn't already being enforced. But I would say that part of the reason I think there needs to be a focus on all residents is there is a lack of affordable housing for year-round residents that aren't students, that the facilities are structured for families instead of two unrelated roommates. that there's not a lot of settings for developmentally disabled or physically disabled adults to live independently. And that's really where I think some dollars and investments need to be made.
All right. Well, if you have any other final thoughts to leave us with, a kind of summary of why you're running and why you'd like people's vote on April 2nd, that'd be great. And then let us know also where people can find out more information about you.
Well, I hope I've been pretty clear on why I've been running. As far as contacting me, my tech support, my husband, Robin Levine, has set me up with a special email account, Karen, K-A-R-Y-N, at votekarensmith.com. The votekarensmith.com is all one word. And I also have a Facebook page with Vote Karen Smith is how you will find me there. I've been attempting to make daily postings to that space, alerting people to what I might be attending, but I did provide an issues commentary, and that got was shared by more than 300 people. So I encourage everyone to, if you need to know more about who I am, go to that space, and if you write me an email, I'll do my best to respond to you within 48 hours, and thank you for your patience, and I'm number 5 on the ballot. Thank you.
Also, not to be confused with Karen Schmidt, who is running for Bloomington City Council. Different people, different spellings of names, but for certain podcasters who are trying to schedule people, it can be quite confusing. Well, Karen, thanks a lot for spending time with us and being so open about your thoughts and perspectives on things, and good luck on April 2nd.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thanks, Karen.
All right, another one in the books here. What'd you think of our conversation with Karen, Zach?
I think it's been really interesting how different a lot of these candidates have been for the normal race in particular. There are so many different perspectives. I hope that there are things learned, no matter who these candidates are, that they really draw from this. Whoever our council ends up being in the town of Normal,
for local races, you know, in the one sense you're politicians, but this is not a job that they're running for. It's not a full-time job.
Right.
You're probably going to spend more money on your race than you actually make in the year if you get elected. And what motivates people to do this is really their sense of civic engagement and wanting to do something better in the community. You know, it's admirable that they're spending their time in this way.
And I think something that I'm reminded of is that anybody running in these situations is passionate about their community. They care deeply for the future of where they live.
So before we wrap up here, I do want to thank our sponsors again. So we're going to thank Normal Gadgets now. Probably all of you at this point have been out to their website to check it out. But for those of you who haven't, they have a frequently asked questions document. And we are going to help you by reading some of these frequently asked questions. So Normal Gadgets frequently asked questions. Do you repair all types of cell phones?
We sure do.
Do you repair all types of gaming consoles?
Of course.
What about laptops?
Yep.
How about smartwatches?
Sure can.
Can you repair my tablet?
Why not?
Do you repair all types of iPods?
You know we do.
So if you have any of those things that are broken or anything else, come on into Normal Gadgets. And of course, also thank you to Little Beaver Brewery and their support that they provided for us as well too. Great to see local businesses doing big things in the community. All right, Zach, well, thanks again for coming on. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
I think we're done.
We're done.
You can't stay here until 4, but they do have some pretty late hours. So come check them out on playnormalesports.com or visit them at 802 South Alt. At 802 South Alt. At 802 South El Dorado Road in Bloomington.